podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast, the podcast about the beautiful club within the beautiful game, with me and my regular co-host Peter Marsh. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Russ.
And welcome back to a guest from the past, I think about a year or so ago, maybe a bit more. It's Mr. Graham Phillips. Hello, Graham.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. As we haven't had you on for a while, and before we get into any other subjects, just got to ask you about how you've been feeling about the Albion since you were last on. We think Graham Potter was probably in charge mid to most way through of his tenure at the time, probably something like that. So you hadn't had the experience of De Zerbi at the time. How have you found Roberto's football? Let's start with that.
Well, you have to pinch yourself, really, don't you? I mean, it's like, and I guess Albion fans, and I'm sort of one of them, being a bit pessimistic as in nature, so always thinking that something, it can't last, surely. But I'm now beginning to think that it might last, that we found the most extraordinarily charismatic head coach who is making players who are, you know, pretty good generally, but making them into superstars. I just don't understand it. I just wonder whether it's ever feasible to do that in grassroots football. You know, you get these kids or something, you just make them fearless. I don't think it is. I think you've got to be an extraordinary personality and be able to impose a wonderful style and willpower onto these professional players. It's amazing. I can't even think. I don't even think someone like Guardiola did that. I think, you know, he had it easy, didn't he? I can't think of a... Potter did it to an extent, but not like this. Amazing.
Yeah, and We thought at the time, we mentioned Graham Potter, we thought at the time we were making great progress, getting a bit more creativity and a bit more excitement in the style and brand of football under him, and that we're going in the right direction. But then with him leaving, going to Chelsea and flopping, you can understand with Chelsea that might just be a Chelsea thing. But with Roberto doing so well, so much more with the same players. Okay, we've had some changes now as well, but already he was making his mark straight away, pretty much, wasn't he? Within a small number of games, it shows Graham Potter up a little bit, doesn't it? In the sense that you wonder now, well, was he all that? Obviously, he was good, but the difference, I think, the chasm between the quality that Graham Potter definitely does have and the clearly elite level coaching that Roberto De Zerbi has is very, very obvious, very evident. And I really think he is an elite coach. I think he's already quite close to the top. He's going all the way to the top, isn't he? He's up there with, you mentioned Guardiola. He's up there with the likes of Guardiola. And one thing, I know Peter wants to come in on this, but just quickly, one more thing as well was, I can't remember who it was. Someone was talking about Roberto De Zerbi visiting Manchester City at some point. It might have been before he started with us. And he was obviously not locking horns. He was chewing the fat with Guardiola, amongst other things. And apparently they were just non-stop talking. They continuously, relentlessly talking with each other about football. No one could get in a word in edgeways, and they literally just left them to it. Because these conversations were long, extensive, incredibly intricate in detail. And you think, well, these guys are just thinking on a different level. They've got so much more motivation, so much more passion. Not that anyone else doesn't, but they've just got so much more drive. I think you have to have that to be the absolute best. Peter?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's ironic, we're talking about Potter, of course, because it was a year today, apparently, that he resigned. And I remember the podcast that evening, there was a lot of kind of like, I think without him to particularly say that I was for the future, I was quite worried about what would happen afterwards. I was the only one probably who wasn't as gutted as everyone else because I'd never been that big a fan of Potter. And I don't think I even imagined that the next manager would get close to what De Zerbi has. I think I just wasn't as gutted because it was only the last 15 games, really. I thought he'd done as well as others maybe had been invested in him. But I think what you're saying about De Zerbi is right. I think how well he's doing is actually more damaging for Potter than his fellow Chelsea. I think Chelsea on its own could be written off as, well, they're a bit of a basket case, so brought these expensive players together. They, you know, he might have sorted out at a given time. But the fact that De Zerbi came in and made players like Solly March look like he has since he came in, when you compare him to what he was like under Potter, where he had at least one decent season where he was very good at left wing back most of the time, but he never looked as like scoring this many goals or even close to. And the way he's like changed players, you know, players like, I mean, Caicedo was only used the last 15 games under Potter. Mm. Whereas I think under De Zerbi he'd have come in a lot earlier, and you know, that team is just changed under him, and we're so lucky to have him. I mean, although we're not lucky because it's clearly forward planning and Boom being aware of the, you know, managers like him existing and, you know, kind of and the team all being aware of, you know, as in we've got, you know, options for every position if that people leave.
I think also...
If I have nothing else to do in life, I think I would probably be maybe rather dully, but quite interestingly for me, look at videos of De Zerbi at other clubs like Sassuolo and Shakhtar Donetsk and see what his style was like and whether it was exactly the same, whether they did the, you know, the risky playing out from the back, the clever one-twos, the one-touch, the sudden pace. I wonder if it was there or whether this is something that he's gradually, you know, built up towards and he thinks, right, this is the Premier League, I could possibly get away with this.
Yeah, because it's interesting because he said something the other day about how we're the furthest away from his normal style of play that he's had of a team, but we're the nearest to his soul, which is an interesting, almost suggesting like he's always wanted to play this way, but has never actually had the players almost. Because I actually think he's gone more extreme this season. Billy Gilmour is literally standing facing goal with like about 8 yards from goal for goal kicks these days and getting the ball and, you know, taking it from there, facing goal away from his opponent. Yeah. I actually think he's got even more kind of hyper De Zerbi this season in terms of the way he plays. And it's, I actually still feel less nervous because I've seen so much more of it now than whereas last season I was worried.
He wouldn't have done it at Norwich, would he, Billy Gilmour? Clearly.
No.
It wouldn't have worked, would it?
No, absolutely not.
And that's the thing, it's like all the Norwich fans writing off Gilmour and then using last season or half of last season as proof that they were right. Forget that their strikers were like Josh Sargent and Pukki, or his name was. Sargent was, who missed an open goal against us at one point. I mean, they had an absolutely appalling team that season, and Gilmour was maybe not very good, but he also wasn't to blame for them going down or anything like that.
Peter, Pukki, your pronunciation makes me sick, I have to say. That's terrible. As was the pun I just come out with there. But no, I think your points stand, definitely. It's about who's managing you, who's coaching you. You know, it's going to be different, isn't it? It was the Norwich, where he wasn't being given a run of games, and obviously he doesn't have the same quality to work with on and off the pitch. It's going to be a totally different ball game. And with De Zerbi, I think you know, he's so motivational. He's giving them different ideas. Everyone that's been interviewed has not only said that the best coach they've worked with and that he's really enthusiastic and motivational, but also that they've been finding out new things about how to play football. Even Lallana and people like that have said that in interviews. And Pascal Grosch, congratulations, by the way, on his first call up to Germany at the age of 32 this week. He's another one who's got a new lease of life. Someone said on WhatsApp, I think today or yesterday, that he seemed to be flailing a little bit under Graham Potter in the final games. He was kind of becoming the loose end a little bit, but he's come right back into, well, the richest vein of form or amongst the richest.
I think towards the end, Potter finally did realise how to get the best out of him. It was that a lot of the time he was there, he was playing in a quite defensive role, and it's like there was one point at Palace, we played Grosch and Lallana in midfield. It's like, what are you doing together? It's like, both great players, but they're not a central midfield pairing. We just basically had no midfield for that game. And it just, I think because Bissouma was out and there was someone else out, it was insane. And I just don't think Potter had the way of getting the best out of players in the same way that even close to that De Zerbi does.
So who hasn't enjoyed playing football under De Zerbi, do you think? I guess Robert Sanchez is probably.
Yeah, Sanchez. Webster, I'd say, is a bit more in and out maybe now, possibly. Yeah.
And people have left, obviously, Alzate. And the likes of Neil Morpay, maybe it was a matter of game time. Maybe it's
left before De Zerbi. It's like, Alzate went on loan before De Zerbi came in last season, didn't he?
Yeah, but he didn't. But he hasn't come back into the equation. No.
And Morpay left for Everton before he came.
Oh yeah, fair enough. That was before, wasn't it? Yeah. But yeah, yeah. I mean, Not many is the answer, I think. And if they don't, there's probably a reason why. It might be an attitude. It might be just one of those rare people that won't fit, just can't fit at all into what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. Robert Sanchez, I think, fits into that category. Whether it's a matter of, I think it's a combination of attitude and he just didn't fancy him as much.
I don't think he regard Nick Pope as a great option in this team, judging by his kicking last weekend.
Indeed, yeah. Well, let's quickly talk about Newcastle. Now you mentioned Nick Pope. Let's round off that. We did a match day special, so a lot of the opinion already covered, but I want to get your views on it as well. First of all, Richard Holberton, who we still keep trying to get back on. He's a great contributor, posts so much good stuff in our WhatsApp groups, but he's never available. Come on, Richard, you've got to come back on. But I am going to quote him. He said in a few days ago, thought we looked good in all areas and better balanced than against West Ham United when much of our early attacking was going through Mittema, and they clearly had a plan for that. JP adds another dimension. Gilmore improving at some rate, and Ferguson phenomenal. Tough for Webster to regain a starting spot unless it really is just rest and rotate, as RDZZ claimed not very convincingly pre-match. Footnote for the trivia buffs, all our yellow cards were for substitutes. This must have been a rarity. I thought previously there should have been an amnesty of, say, 4 matches before accumulation kicks in to allow players to get used to the new rules. Happens with parking regulations, he says. We'll come on to the new rules with Graham from your qualified ref capacity a little bit later on. But in terms of comments on Newcastle, either what Richards has said or your own thoughts on the game, obviously a great result, good performance as well, and a really good atmosphere right from the start, which helps. Other than those basic facts and the fact we won the game, which is great, what did you make of it? Who were your standout players? Well, was there anything you noticed
first of all,
as well?
I think I was really surprised Newcastle didn't just play like West Ham. I thought they would. I thought that's probably, Eddie Howe would probably work something out, but, you know, we would run into these blocks of players, sort of banks of midfield players and banks of defenders, and get nowhere. But I suppose they were struggling a bit having to put Byrne into the middle of the back four. That clearly was a bad move for them. Not that I think Lascelles would have been any better, but after those early blips where they missed a couple of chances, but you know, it was sort of early days for them. I thought they were sort of very meek and mild and lacking interest. And in fact, I have to say that I saw what was admittedly a weaker Newcastle side dominated by the Albion in New York in the friendly. And it was almost like a carbon copy of that. It was like, you know, Isak was playing up front and doing a bit of chasing, but he looked around and other players didn't bother chasing very much. Almiron was pathetic in that case. And you can't give a team like the Albion that amount of space. I thought they played a really poor game. And I think he got found out badly, Eddie Howe, really did, which is good.
Absolutely. And the only recognisable traits out and out were the shithouse tactics. Yeah, there's lots of niggly fouls.
Yeah.
Dan Byrne was probably, I mean, you mentioned him, he was bloody awful in this game. And his only modus operandi seemed to be to just keep doing niggly fouls. To try and undermine our flow, which of course is a Howe trait, isn't it? And Anthony Gordon,
he was very late to get booked, I thought. He was. Late tackles, probably.
Yeah. On the other hand, Anthony Gordon did get booked pretty much the first time he caused an infringement. It was a bookable offence anyway, but he's got away with murder this season. And I was really glad that he was booked so soon into the game, because I think that that also affected him. It inhibited some of his game, where the shithousery side of the game that he likes to do. You know, he got Trent Alexander booked and almost got him sent off indirectly as a result of that foul. But it was a blatant foul, wasn't it, that game? And he shouldn't have been on the pitch, because he should have been suspended for at least 2, maybe 3 yellows the week before. But he got, as I said, he was picked up on straight away in this game. As soon as he did something worthy of a yellow, he was given it, rightly. And I think that helped as well. And it was a pale shadow of the usual Eddie Howe team, wasn't it, really? Peter, would you, I know Peter's eating, I think, but he might come in a minute on that one. But I mean, I don't know if you'd agree.
Yeah, I agree. I think they couldn't deal with us, basically. The pace of Pedro and Ferguson up front, they just couldn't deal with them. Burn and Shaw were really poor. Both of them should have been booked significantly earlier. Mm. Yes. And I thought, generally, all round, we handled them really well. Beltman came in, did really well. Van Hecke had a really good game, barring the goal where he should argue have done a bit better. But we could give that at 3-0, 3-0 up with, you know, 2 minutes left or whatever. And yeah, up front, they just couldn't deal with us. And it was, yeah, really, really good game. And it's nice to beat them, especially to beat Eddie Howe's team and to beat Newcastle as well, obviously with their rather dodgy owners.
Yeah,
they were the three unsung heroes, weren't they? I mean, a lot, the media sort of pounced on Ferguson rightly, and then the Albion sort of, you know, bigged up Pedro. But for me, it was the strength and sort of solid performances of Gilmore, Van Heck and Veltman that were outstanding, really.
Yeah, all of them were outstanding, weren't they? Veltman definitely gave greater balance and I think just looked so much more comfortable there than what we've put in before.
And Gordon really have a lot. I mean, Gordon was great, I thought. You know, really skillful, really looked good, but he never really got around Veltman. Not really.
And I agree with you on Gilmore. I think Gilmore is really flourishing now. He's got these issues off the pitch that are no fault of his own seem to be behind him now. And it's no coincidence that he's now coming back to the player that we'd seen at Chelsea and are now seeing with the Albion. I think he's really flourishing. He's flourishing under Roberto. I think he's flourishing in general for freedom of not having those issues off the field. And he's looking like he's owning the role, isn't he? And I can see him holding his place down. I know we will have this rotation element that Richard mentioned in that message we mentioned a moment ago, but there will be some level of rotation involved. But I do think he's going to play a significant part, and he'll play way more than 50% of the games, that's for sure, going forwards, I think. If it wasn't for that, I mean, you can't not give Ferguson man of the match when he scores a hat-trick, albeit one of them was deflected, but it was on target, so it's been attributed to him. So he scored three goals, in essence. It's hard not to give him man of the match, and, you know, the sponsors did. I think the TV guys did as well. But Gilmore, if you just look on the overall performance, he's right up there, isn't he, I think, in that match?
Yeah. And I mean, he never scores a goal, does he? He's really unlucky. That shot was fantastic.
The one that led to the first goal,
usually we see those go ballooning over the bar, don't we? And go all over the place or slice to the corner flag. But the way, you know, he really kept it down beautifully. I mean, it gave Pope real problems, I think.
Yeah, you can't blame Pope, really. It was such a searing shot. All he could do was try and parry it and then just hope it would happen to bounce somewhere to safety. You couldn't really get any direction on the save, could you? And there was Ferguson to pop it away.
Yeah, I think he actually tried to get it into his chest. I think he did try to do that. It was probably a mistake, but goalkeepers, I think, good goalkeepers don't like parrying the ball straight out, do they? Is what he ended up doing because he couldn't hold it or couldn't get anywhere near to hold it. But, very dangerous thing to do. It was wonderful. I thought, fantastic.
And it's good that the midfield seems to be resolving itself a little bit. I mean, just to refer to another couple of posts we've had recently, Alan, friend of the show, of course, he posted something on WhatsApp. I think it was after the last game, I think it was after the West Ham game, he said, there is a debate to be had about our long-term forward planning of our defensive unit. We sold White after a year and players like Roberts, Tsongi, Kobovnik, all should be coming through at senior level now, have not reached that level and have been offloaded. Still overly reliant on Dunk's presence. Not wanting to reopen the Caicedo debate, but needs to be said that I'm sure up to last Christmas, we did not expect him to leave. I know it can be argued that we knew he was going from January, but 6 months is not enough time in the way we forward plan in getting a young player through the system where we do not have a break to break our wage structure to get someone Premier League ready-made. We do not want to get someone in who's average. We want to find a gem who becomes a high-level player, and that takes time. And Andy Bass, another friend of the show, same day said, we have to be patient with the midfield. You don't replace Mac and Moses overnight. It will take a while for the new heart of the team to start beating properly. Hopefully Baleba will help with that process. And I know, you know, we're still waiting to see Baleba, but it looks like we're starting to rectify those points being made already. And one other quote as well from your son, who was on the podcast with you last time you came on, Jack Phillips, said, also worth remembering that when RDZ came in, we hadn't really used Mittema, Ferguson and Ciso, Van Hecker, Buonanotte or Gilmore. All of those will play an important part this season. Add to that the experience of Dahoud, Igor and Milner, as well as exciting new attacking talent in Pedro and Adingra. It's so much stronger of a squad, even if our two midfield stars are no longer here. So, I mean, how do you guys see us in terms of our midfield now? Do you think we've, obviously, notwithstanding Baleba, we don't know, we've got to see
that's the key, isn't it, though?
Is that going to be the thing? Is that going to be the key?
I think that will be, I mean, I'm not saying he'll immediately be brilliant because, I mean, yeah, Casado was, but Bissouma wasn't, and others, but I think he is the key.
Yeah.
The succession planning. If he doesn't do it or takes a while to settle in, we do have, I mean, even Saturday, there were big gaps in our midfield, which Newcastle, if they'd taken their chances, they had two really good chances at the start. They had chances after both our first and second goals where they should have done more with them as well. You know, there other nights they could have scored early and got ahead, and then we know from West Ham how difficult that is to come back. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for all the, especially with the games we've got coming up, you know, it's for all the, it was a brilliant result. Newcastle and other night would have taken their chances, and then, you know, obviously it's a different game.
Yeah, two very different voices in the football world. Chris Boyd, former player who works for Sky Sports News on Soccer Saturday, and James Horncastle, who's a rather more discerning journalist, who's an expert on Italian football. Leeds fan, though, Peter, but anyway, never mind. They both described in the last week or so Brighton as being the best-run club in the world. And you've got a pretty good argument to say they're right. Even with that, and with the great succession planning we have, there's still going to be some anomalies and some mistakes. In this case, a bit of an anomaly in that we obviously knew we were going to need to replace Casado before we even got him in, probably. You know, we're planning out far ahead. But sometimes these jolts in the system are going to happen no matter how well run we are, aren't they? There's going to be moments where we know we need to replace Casado. Baleba probably is the man for that, but it's, you know, we've just got him in and he's young and he hasn't had time to be blooded in. And, you know, it's not going to be seamless. Do you reckon we're going to overcome that? Are we going to be surviving that and still doing well this season?
I think that you have to go back a bit to Bissouma going, and I think that we were quite patient with Bissouma as fans and maybe as a team. He was fairly erratic, I think, as a player. Obviously skillful and had talent, but he would do weird things. You know, his shooting was appalling. And sometimes he'd get caught, dwelling on the ball. But he then became a brilliant player. And he played for a long time as a brilliant player, I think, under Potter, before Casado was introduced. And I think, and then we had no thought about Casado coming in with Bissouma, and even strengthening the midfield even more. So I think it's all, you know, you have to be fairly tolerant of the way the club is progressing, I think, now. Certainly they've taught us all a lesson about sort of overreacting about when are we going to get a striker, you know, that's long gone now. So I think as fans, we probably have to be tolerant about the club knowing what to do when they sell players like McAllister and Casado. And maybe Baleba is just going to be another great player that's come from nowhere. Maybe Buonanotte is going to suddenly flourish as he is expected to. You know, South American Carlos Tevez said, you know, he's a wonderful player. He's going to be a fabulous player. We've yet to see that, perhaps, but it's a matter of time. Maybe.
And we've not played him in his position. I mean, he's not really a winger. from what you hear. He's a set attacking midfielder. So the problem is for him is we have a lot of options in that position. And that's the issue that he's got to face and he's got to, earn his spot. But I mean, in a way, what better season to do that given the number of games we're going to get? I mean, I'm sure he'll play at Chelsea. He may well start at least one or two of the European games after, because they'll probably look at that and think, well, actually, players like Buonanotte probably suit the European game better than players who may be in the Premier League who suit that better. So, kind of depending on. So there'll be a lot of, interchange of players this season. And we then see, so out till Christmas, Buonanotte's got a chance to really kind of like put his name in the ring for like kind of future places or whatever. But I mean, Enciso was such a gutter. That game at Wolves, he destroyed them in the second half. Those assists were just superb. And to lose him for so long.
Yeah. Well, there's another example of a player that's come from nowhere, which, you would never. And this is the thing, there are bound to be more, aren't there? There are going to be more players coming from nowhere.
As you were saying, April, we didn't have anything. Gilmore had barely started. Yeah. Enciso had barely started. And now they're two, when Enciso's fit, two crucial parts of the squad. Yeah. Undav as well, who obviously has gone on loan now, but became a crucial part of the squad at that stage of the season when we needed him. Got some, maybe isn't the most best all-round player, but he got some really crucial goals.
Yeah. I would imagine, that the club are looking to purchase or bring on talented youngsters, either that they found abroad or that they've got at the training ground, which fans don't know anything about because they're not necessarily tuned in, who are going to be brilliant. I would imagine that's currently the case. Whether that model would carry on forever, I really don't care, because football's cyclical, and this is what you have to do. You have to really enjoy it when it's great and not think about when it's going to be bad, despite me earlier saying that I'm a pessimist by nature.
I think I agree. I mean, I never considered that we get to Europe until halfway through last season, I think I started to wonder.
Yeah.
But before that, we were until the last few games of that previous season, we were pretty much always 15th to 17th, occasionally up to 14th, 13th, sort of Premier League. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly that late run pushed to the 9th. And then obviously we built on that. This is more than I thought we'd ever achieve. So, the idea of we're planning trips to Athens, Amsterdam and Marseille, just insane, really, frankly.
Yeah, indeed. And on that subject, Graham, are you going to any of the European games? What's your status on that one?
Well, I am. I've booked all these, apart from Athens, which I'm sort of currently thinking I might stall on for a bit. I'm already booked to go to Marseille with no tickets. Booked to go to Marseille and Ajax. And I've spent hours trying to work out the cheapest way of going. The cheapest but most pleasant way of going, bearing in mind I won't spend £1,000 on a hotel room in the centre of Amsterdam. So, so I'm not going to tell you what they all are, because otherwise, well, of course, it's too late. I've booked them all now, so, I could tell you, but I'm going by train and plane and Airbnb and, all that. So, it's all very civilised, I hope.
Fantastic. Well, Peter, you're going to all three, aren't you?
Yeah.
I'm very jealous because I wish I could do that. I'm skipping Marseille. Athens is still in debate. I am going to Ajax. So definitely, Graham, we can all meet up for that one. There'll be a number of people over there. We'll be doing our first Euro match day specials, I'm sure, as well, or match day special for that one. Really looking forward to it. Can't wait. And as you said, it's a pinch yourself time, isn't it? It really is still feeling a bit surreal. It doesn't quite feel it's happening yet.
I mean, our next nine games are, what's it, like, United, AEK Athens, Bournemouth, which is an ironic one, Chelsea,
Villa.
Liverpool, I put Athens, and then Marseille, Liverpool, Man City, Ajax. That's our next, and I might have missed one as well, or Villa. And then, so that's our next nine games. It's like slightly insane.
Amazing,
we'll
isn't
win
it?
Them all, I think we'll win them
If we win them all, I think I might believe we're going to win the league, to be honest, and the Europa League and the quadruple. Yeah.
Would you, if you won them all, would you be a believer, would you? Because that's the possible new scene for Carlos, isn't it? Yeah. And anyone that knows him, Crispy, who I'm acquainted with, is in a WhatsApp group with me, and he's come up with some lyrics. I'm not going to sing it because that would just be too unpleasant. But it's the words to "I'm a Believer" by the Monkees. He's come up with, "I thought that this season would be tougher. Casado and Mac would be a loss, but now they're gone and we move on. No one at Brighton gives a toss. Because have you seen his pace? Carlos Baleva. Not a trace, no doubt in my mind. He's our ace. Woo! Cameroonian midfielder, Carlos Baleva. What a find." Followed by, of course, down.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's going to remember all the words for that.
Yeah, it's a bit wordy, but Tim does like a bit of a...
Everyone's just going to sing Baleva.
Yeah. He's not a season ticket holder anymore. He goes to games when he can, but he used to do a lot of the singing in the North Stand back in the day. So hello to Tim, if you're listening. I've put him onto my podcast in recent weeks, so he might be. If you are, good effort, sir. Anyway.
I certainly remember him at Withdean. I think he used to shout a lot at Withdean, didn't he?
Yes, that would probably be true. Yes, that sounds about right. On the internationals, we're speaking on Thursday. You mentioned actually the anniversary of Graham Potter resigning. It's also courtesy of a friend of mine, Wedge, who's pointed out that it's the 42nd birthday of Only Fools and Horses today, the 8th of September. The first ever episode Big Brother was broadcast on the 8th of September 1981. I'm sure everyone wanted and needed to know that. I'll pop it in there as it happened to be mentioned. But it's also, of course, the International Week coming up. So we've got a break from games. So there's nothing to talk about in terms of an upcoming match for the Albion. But, of course, internationals do mean some involvement for Albion players. We've mentioned Pascal Gross. Congratulations on his first call up to Germany. Starting with him, I mean, a fantastic career he's had with us. He signed for us in the summer when we were just about to start in the Premier League. So he's been with us as long as we've been in the Prem. And he's been a fantastic signing, as good a value as anybody really along the way, hasn't he? He's had peaks and troughs a little bit, but generally he's been a great servant. He has, in just a couple of weeks ago, become, when he scored the consolation against West Ham, become the Premier League era top scorer for the Albion with 27 goals, going ahead of Glenn and Neil Morpay, I think it is. I don't know what Michael Robinson's record is offhand, actually, but he can't be too far behind that as well. If he stays with us for the rest of his career, he might beat whatever that record is. And apart from him not beating the first man on corners quite a number of times too often, he's been brilliant, hasn't he? And there's some superb stats, actually, which have come up in the recent last couple of weeks. Where was it? I think it was actually after the last game. There's a stat which says that, if I can just get my details up, the most chances created this season so far is Pascal Grosch with 16. This is after the weekend's match. Kauro Mitoma is joint second with 14, along with Bukayo Saka and Bruno Fernandes. And I think there was a stat that a friend of the show, Robin, mentioned, which was that since he signed for us, Kevin De Bruyne is the only person who's created more chances than Pascal Grosch in that period, so since 2017. Incredible stats.
And when you consider we weren't that great a team for a lot of that, especially under Houghton when we were quite defensive. And then even under Potter, we did both. I suppose we did create more chances, but we were still more limited up front and that sort of thing. So it's quite stunning, really, for someone of his, considering the level we've been at for most of that time, to be in that situation.
I think there should be a stat, or someone should get some stats together about how many Cruyff turns Pascal has done in his career at Brighton, and how many have been successful and how many have been unsuccessful. I would say that very few would be unsuccessful.
No one seems to have worked it out. No, and of course he gets to do it in the Johan Cruyff Arena potentially later this season.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is going to be great.
I think his German career, because Flick is under big pressure in Germany, isn't he? So
yeah.
Although he's got two friendly games, they've gone off in big time, haven't they? So not playing well. I don't think they won many games in the last sort of 16, very few. And so they're playing Japan and France, which is not really easy. So I reckon Pascal will not play because he'll be too frightened to be, or sort of experimental with bringing on Pascal. He'll get maybe 5 minutes if they're winning or drawing at the end of maybe one of the games. But I'm usually wrong when it comes to things like that. So he'll probably play both games for, without doing
it doesn't feel like there's an awful lot of point, though, of calling him up at 32 without playing him in a way, I'd say. I mean, what if you're 21, I'd kind of understand it. You can give him experience of it, but there's limited point at, like, yeah, his age.
Yeah.
One other stat, actually, and this is not surprising based on what I've already said, but in 2023-24 so far, he's created more chances than any other player in Europe's big five leagues. Just another stat to commend him on. But, yeah, I think you're right, Graham, about the pressure on Flick, that's for sure. No easy games there, is it, those two matches? Not easy to get results in those, whether they're friendlies or not, if there's scrutiny on them.
Yeah.
Those are pressure games. And, yeah, I don't know if he'll get any time or not, but... It's interesting that he's been called up at this point in time. I suppose he's at a peak in his career, but still, it feels a bit of an odd one, maybe.
It's the Roberto De Zerbi, you know, magic, isn't it? Everybody's watching Brighton now. You know, whether I read something about somebody, a coach gets somewhere, I don't know whether it's in the UK or whether it's in Europe, that every Monday morning they get the Brighton footage and they just watch it as a coaching team, you know, to see what's going on. And I think there's an element of that. I think people going, how is he doing this? You know, how is he doing? And how do players like Pascal Gross fit into that? You know, because they were just like, you know, routine, unsung heroes that, you know, never play for Germany, never might go to Liverpool. Oh, no, he won't go to Liverpool. It was all about that, wasn't it? But now I think coaches are thinking, well, if he can play and deserve his squad and he gets his place virtually every week, I'm going to pull him up.
Yeah, I think there's a shift in perspective. And, he can finish. That's the thing. I mean, great finish against West Ham. The game, brilliant volley. Was it against Everton? I can't remember last season.
The Wolves one. The Everton one was a chip when he went through, where they basically set him up and he went through and chipped the keeper.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So some great goals. Someone else who's got great goals, but probably, I fear, will not overtake Pascal Grosch as our record scorer in the top flight, or Michael Robinson, and definitely won't overtake our record ever scorer for club, was probably going to be Evan Ferguson, because I fear that we will not keep him for long enough for him to achieve that record, no matter how quickly he scores the goals. He's got 10 already in the Premier League. I think it's 12 or 13 in all competitions. So he's 1/10 of the way to the Premier League 100 club already, which is incredible. But he has been injured. He reported for training with Ireland. Apparently a knee injury of some description was uncovered. So he's been immediately ruled out of both their games, which a gutter for all the Irish, because they are competitive qualifiers for the Euros for 2024. But he's, sitting out of those two games. Speculation then mounting as to whether he might change allegiance, because, of course, his mum is English. I really, really doubt that. I think he's an Irish.
I don't think he can.
No, well, no, there's new rules, isn't there? Because if you play,
I think the debate was whether it's friendlies and non-friendlies, and it both counts. So he's played significantly more than the minimum. I actually don't necessarily agree with the logic that he'll go, because there's always talk about whether he'll go this summer and stuff like that next summer. But he was a player who came to us to get first team football. Now, if he goes to Liverpool or Man U or Tottenham in the summer, there's no guarantee of that. He needs game time. He's only 18. I could see him staying 3 years and having three full seasons with us. He's still only 21 then. He's probably earning. We could probably happily give him more money as well, because if he keeps developing, we'll probably give him a pretty good wage again, which he's probably already on at this point. He got a new contract, 5-year deal, once he'd already broken through, didn't he? So I could see him staying three seasons and being like, well, actually, I'm going to be 21 then, or whatever, still. I've still got almost all my career ahead of me, mainly because he made that decision to come to us in the first place to get game time, and so he doesn't want to do...
I think that's a fair point, and it's entirely feasible. I could see him staying for 3 years. So, he could catch Pascal, he could catch Michael Robinson. He won't.
I think if he stays for 3 years, he'll catch everyone, basically. Yeah.
Barring some
crazy... I think
crazy
he'll get double figures each of those seasons quite comfortably. I mean, especially if we're still playing the way we are now.
Yeah. I don't think we get the Harry Kane scenario where he stays with us for so long that he racks up records. I mean, that's one, but that's fair enough, you know.
I know we're not Liverpool, but I've got a feeling Michael Owen stayed with Liverpool quite a while before he went to Real Madrid. And I think, you know, they didn't win a great deal, did they, with him in the side, I don't think.
No.
They were great. I mean, he was prolific and fantastic. He did his career no harm staying at Liverpool. I know we're not Liverpool, so you can't really compare, but they probably weren't, I think they got a cup win maybe, but they didn't get a lot else. We're in Europe, of course. Yeah. But why not, you know?
But yeah, those stats last weekend were a real reminder of how good Owen was at such a young age, because it was the number of hat-tricks in the Premier League under 19-year-olds. Yeah. And it was one for Chris Bart-Williams, one for Robbie Fowler, one for Evan Ferguson, and I think three for Michael Owen,
yeah,
which is an incredible record to have three Premier League hat-tricks by the time before you're 19. That is phenomenal. And because of his injuries and because of the problems he had later in his career, and maybe one or two poor transfers didn't really work out, you forget. But at that point, he was stunning player.
Yeah. It's when he bulked up too much that he lost a bit of pace, and then the hamstrings came as well, and it seemed to go off the boil a bit. I mean, he's still a great player, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's in very esteemed and very rare company, isn't it? That stat of scoring a hat-trick at that age. Yeah. And fantastic for him. I just hope the injury isn't too serious, of course. I've got a client at the moment who's Irish, and he's lamenting the missing of him for these two games. He thinks they're crucial. Yeah. And he thinks Kenny's on his way now. That will probably do for him. But he's also so excited to have such a talent, to have a whole career's worth of time ahead of him. And of course, you've got Andrew Moran, who is looking a really, really good attacking midfielder in our ranks. And we've also got who's played and I think scored as well for the Islands. Is it the
U21s? Yeah,
U21s team, which is Peter.
Well, we're not sure between Marco Mahoney or Marco. What's his name? One or the other.
Could be Marnie. Yeah.
Marnie, I think
he's got four or five goals for the U23s this season. Well, he looks quite an interesting another of our Irish prospects that we could. Thing. I mean, I don't want to overhype Ferguson, obviously, because you know the last thing you want to do is do that. But I don't think it's crazy to say that he could be the Irish equivalent of Bale. That actually he could really kind of inspire Ireland to a number of tournaments, which is what Bale's essentially done in recent years. Wales hadn't qualified for so long, and Bale not single handedly, but certainly it was the major influence in that kind of happening. And it's not impossible to say Ireland will have the same from Ferguson, because he is genuinely that good and he's only 18. He destroyed Newcastle last weekend.
And in essence, he should have had a hat-trick against West Ham. He had three dangerous chances that were not saved. Yeah, one or two could have got maybe further in the corner, but they were still pretty dangerous chances. And
he hit the post with a brilliant effort at Wolves as well.
Yeah.
Is it Wolves? So, he on the turn where he hit it. Was that the Wolves game, I think?
I think so. Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great if he could actually get to the 100 club with us? If he could stay long enough for that? It's a dream. It's a fantasy probably, but it would be fantastic. Couple of youth players who really didn't have such a great story for sure we've had in the past James Tilley, who of course moved on. He went to Crawley, went elsewhere. He's now ended up at Wimbledon. He scored 5 goals in 5 games. So it looks like he's found his club, you know, just the right place for him. He's on fire at the moment. And one other word about former Albion players, Danny Cashman, who we had on the podcast when he was still at the Albion a couple of years ago as a young up and comer. He moved on. I can't remember where he went to. Was it Wickham or somewhere?
Wasn't it? And then he went on loan to a few places.
Oh, that's right. And he's ended up at Worthing, the latest Albion Academy graduate to end up at Worthing, where Dean Cox was for a while, where Reece Meekums is, where Jake Robinson. And someone else as well, Kane Wills, the midfielder. And that's the ones that I can recall offhand. There might be others as well besides. So good luck to Danny in his new role there. Worthing are having a good season. Except
on a Sussex ex-Albion note, I noticed that Carl Emerson, who was the one who signed for Blackpool from us, the youngster, signed for Eastbourne on loan today.
Oh, right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Emerson, wasn't it? The striker who at one point was talked about in the same kind of way as Ferguson, and was like, they were both in the youth team together.
Also, Laurent Tolai, the Albanian British guy who was a really fiery scorer in the youth ranks, had a bad injury just when it looked like he might be able to get a loan or even a break into the team. Never quite seemed the same, but he has then been sold. I think he ended up at, was it Peterborough?
Salford.
Where is it? Salford.
He goes to Salford on loan.
Yeah, it might be Salford. And he's ended up, he was a temporary goalkeeper after their guy got sent off after about 3 minutes.
This season's Aldershot.
Aldershot, that was it. Yeah, Aldershot. So, yeah, the goalkeeper got sent off. He was put in place because they didn't have a goalie on the bench. And he was then subbed from his goalie rank, at least. I think he stayed on the pitch.
Yeah, he went out front. They wanted an extra option up front.
Yeah, kind of a bit bizarre scenario. There's been a few of those. Also, some weird, speaking of lower leagues, Portsmouth, I think they've had two games this season where they've had to call someone out of the crowd, qualified ref, because of injuries and issues going on with fourth officials and refs and so on and so forth. So, Graham, I'm sure you're smiling away about this one. Have you had to do that ever?
Have I had to do that? No, I've never had to do that. And I don't think I'd have been tempted. First of all, how on earth would you? You're watching Brighton and they're drawing 1-1 and you suddenly have to go and run the line. I mean, you have to be incredibly, it would be awful, wouldn't it? You'd be totally unprepared for a start. You'd be lining your favourite team, which would be really, really difficult. So you would probably err on the cautious side and give offsides when they were clearly not. Always against Brighton, because you'd be thinking, I must not be seen to be biased. Because you can bet your life, if a spectator who was a qualified referee watching Portsmouth or Brighton in the home crowd went on a line, you can bet your life the players in that line and the away team would be having a real go at you.
I'd be hurling abuse at you on social media, Graham, afterwards, for sure, definitely.
Absolutely.
If you'd be harsh on Albion.
I think it's nothing worse. The only time I've ever seen it was when I was really young and Jimmy Hill famously ran the line, like a pop star. He's suddenly at Highbury for an Arsenal game. He ran the line in his tracksuit and was okay. He's a qualified referee, but I don't think he'd ever refereed. I had just done the exam. And he was all right, but he loved it, of course, because it was a chance to be on telly and doing something weird.
I'm not sure if I believe that story, Graham. Jimmy, you reckon? I'm just rubbing my chin here. Anyone of a certain age will know that joke. Sorry for anyone that doesn't. Right. Well, we'll talk a bit more about refs. We're going to have a quick break. In part two, we'll talk a bit more about the reffing side of things. There's the new rules that have come out this season. We've got the new thing that's been proposed about VAR audio being heard as well, which has just come in this weekend, just gone. And there's a few controversies, and I've got a couple of rants to do as well. Right, so we're back then with Peter and with Graham. Now, Graham, I've got to say, watching quite a bit of Sky Sports for my sins, watching Sky Sports News, and I'm very familiar with seeing a lot of, the usual typical Zoom equivalents being broadcast on the screen. And quite often I've seen a very similar visage to your good self. Have people compared you with Mr. Damon Hill at all, by any chance?
Oh, that's quite nice. He's a handsome guy.
You have the same, you've got kind of like the slight stylish silver hair, the goatee. It's very similar.
Yeah, that's good. I never thought of that, no.
Do you drive very fast on the roads at all?
Really slowly. Really slowly and really angrily. everybody else is to blame. David Hill wouldn't drive like that either. They're all rubbish. What's they doing now?
Peter and I, obviously, we know you through Seagulls Over London. You're a London-based Brighton fan. You've already given us your story in the past, so we won't go into that. We've had the pleasure of your company, or I have anyway, on the way down to games a few times on the train. It's all great. And you're a season ticket holder, aren't you, as well?
I am.
And it's wonderful, wonderful stuff to be a Brighton fan. You also are a qualified ref, as we mentioned earlier on. So we won't ask you to go into your backstory on that one either at the moment. But we have got quite a few refing-related stories that have come up this year. As with every season, there's some new rules have come in. This season's rules have largely centred around the dissent and time-wasting issues. There are other rules that have come in as well. Can you tell us your thoughts on those rules, whether you think they're good laws, rules, whichever you want to call them?
First of all, I'm an assessor of referees as well as a referee, although I don't referee a lot these days because I mostly watch referees and assess them, which is okay. It's quite relaxed and it's not easy to be upgraded after an assessment, but it's not particularly hard either if you are fairly good at what you do. And I do that for Middlesex County Football Association. and I used to be a Sussex referee many years ago. But back to your question. I think I said that because it's quite difficult when you're talking to referees quite extensively before half-time and after the game about the way they referee a game and how they interpret the laws of the game. Because the laws of the game haven't changed really radically at grassroots level. But boy, have they changed at Premier League level. I just don't know quite how the interpretation of shoves and pushes and shirt pulls and blocking and handball is working in the Premier League. It just is so difficult to really work it out. And I think referees are probably struggling with it as well. And they must go out, Premier League referees must go out before a match thinking, I've really, really got to try and get my head round these law changes and how I interpret them. And I really have to get a lot of help from VAR. That's a bit of a shame because referees only, you know, generally only get help from, to some extent, a fourth official, but mainly from their assistants, from their linesmen. So to change that all so that you're dependent on someone in an earpiece telling you what they might have seen, that you need to go and look at something or you may be totally wrong, must be really disconcerting. And it's no, in my opinion, it's no, it's pretty obvious that some referees, Anthony Taylor will not do VAR. He doesn't do VAR because he can't stand it. He can't stand, the difficulty of having to interpret a really tough decision on the field of play in a very short time with very limited facilities. And I will finish in a second, but I'll just say that Sky, when they televise a game and they look at decisions, offside, penalties, you name it, late challenges, they're looking at multi-angles with a lot of cameras, with a lot of technicians in the studio. The VAR are looking at one screen with one technician who's rolling it back and putting it and looking at it at a different angle on the same screen. That's why it takes so long, and that's why it's not ideal. And that's why the Premier League, before we get into talking about telling the public what's going on, the Premier League need to spend some money on better technical facilities when they look at the VAR.
I'm honest, I had no idea about that. That is madness if they're not, you know, the amount of money in the Premier League that they're not providing them with the resources that they need. That's insane. That's, yeah, well, it just makes no sense.
What they're doing is they're providing a VAR person and a VAR assistant and a technician. So there are three people. If you go to the big, if you look to the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, you had a few technicians and you had a few VAR people, three or four of them. So for bigger games and different organizations, they're putting more people on, but there are too many games, obviously, to be watched at the same time at Stockley Park, and there are only so many studios and so many facilities that PPMOL have available to them, and I think that's a big mistake.
Yeah, and as you said, Graham, the everything is tailored to the standard of Sky's world-class broadcast service. You know, they've got multi-angles, very fast with the editing, the picture editing, choice of shots, how quickly they get the shot from one to another for the viewing pleasure and for obviously for the professionals to commentate on is completely different to what a small number of people who haven't done that as a living for the whole of their lives is having to do when they're looking at it from a just a refereeing point of view and without the technical skills, which is it's impossible. If we're going to be held to those standards, it's obviously going to fall short, isn't it? There's just too much of a disparity between the two, and the fans will get angry with what they can see in far more detail than the refs. And there is a time constraint, obviously, on deciding on the decisions. And we'll get on to the latest audio VAR stuff that's being broadcast now, which is based on an experiment they did as a one-off late last season, didn't they, with Howard Webb, who's looking to try and demonstrate the process and to show how difficult it is to do things in time constraints, which I do have some sympathy with, having seen that. They brought that in again from last weekend onwards now. So they looked at the Man City Fulham game, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think, again, even with lots of frenetic decision-making going on, no one's hanging around pondering anything. They are trying to make a decision. They're discussing very quickly. Ultimately, it still takes a bit too long for me. But anyway, Peter, we'll get on to the Man City Fulham game.
I was going to say that was one of the examples I was going to use, because to me, even if you don't have the greatest view, that clearly was offside. I don't understand how he got away with that. But I was going to say, I think this backs up what I've been saying for a while and what other people have on the various WhatsApp groups, that I think there should be two separate groups, one referees group and one VAR group. And, you know, there's all this talk about some, you know, like the Mike Dean thing the other day about it, you know, didn't want to undermine his mate and that sort of thing. And similarly, there's been suggestions that maybe the more inexperienced referees have been a bit not so sure about overruling or suggesting that a more experienced official on the pitch goes to VAR. So you go over that. They're different qualifications. You don't need to be fit to be VAR. You don't need to necessarily have the same level of, you know, kind of same eyesight, that sort of thing, as good as VAR. What you do need, though, is to be able to work the technology and also to be able to, like, deal with it, and also to, you know the rules, and that's fine. So you're taking a different pool of people. So yeah, I think there should be different people for VAR. I think it sounds like the technology is not up to it. They should make the technology better, and that's the only hope they've got, really, that make VAR work, because at the moment there's so many mistakes, almost more than there were before, in my view.
And Graham, we'll come back to you on the response for that in a minute. But one thing to add to that as well, looking at that Man City Fulham game, essentially you could see all the rationale and the way that the conversation was shown. You can see they've very efficiently gone to talk about this. Is it offside? If so, is there any other component parts to it? And then is it interfering with the player? And their rationale, when you look at it, if you don't know, if you didn't play the game, or if you didn't have a bit more of a wider view on football, you might look at hear what's being said and think, oh, that sounds rational. It didn't affect his trajectory, the goalkeeper, because he looked like he was making the movement straight away, etc. But the rule is he interfering with the goalkeeper's judgment? By default, he is, because the goalkeeper... They talk about tenths of seconds with reactions, and the difference between that world-class save and just being a good goalkeeper is about that incredible speed of thought and reaction time. And even though it looks, looking at the screen, as if the goalkeeper has gone straight for the ball and just missed it and hadn't been affected by the player being there, even if that were to be true, even if the goalkeeper later said, yeah, I don't think it was affecting me, which of course he wouldn't say, but if he did... You can argue that may not be the case, even if he thinks it is, because speed of thought, that fractions of a second matter to goalkeepers at the elite level. And you have to have at the back of your mind a bit of an element of doubt as to whether a contact's being made. The goalkeeper can't guarantee, A, that that player is offside, even if he thinks he is, and B, whether it's going to be given, even if he is offside. So he would have to take into account contacts on the ball. So there's going to be, even if he's expecting the player to jump over the ball, which he did do, and it seems like he didn't try to play it, you've still got that could affect you by just a split second. And that could be the difference with getting a fingertip to that ball. So that's what the players have said that. I'm just reiterating what I've heard them say. Goalkeepers have said that this week. And if that's the case, if that's true, then you have to give it as offside, don't you? And Howard Webb has come out and said that particular instance, that shouldn't have been allowed, that goal. But it's people who presumably haven't played the game to any significant level who have made those decisions. Is that part of the problem? Is it that you need a goalkeeper or someone that at least has the rationale that we've just been talking about? in their heads when they make those decisions. I can see how it's a very fast-paced scenario. It's a very quickly moving pieces, isn't it? I think how Webb said there were two elements they had to marry up and try and balance into their consideration. But ultimately, if you can't make a decision quickly enough, you have to go with the obvious, don't you? But anyway, Graham, over to you on this one.
Okay, so...
Lots to unpack there, I know, sorry.
A couple of points, really. First of all, the players are the worst to be referees. Ex-players are terrible referees, generally. They tend to err on the basis that there's no such thing as a foul. You've got to be take it all, give everything, take it, give it back, that sort of thing. Well, that's not what football's about. It might be what it's about for certain players, but I know this is a generalization, but this can really happen. You've really got to study the game and really work hard to manage a game of football. And you can't just be sort of laissez-faire. You have to be very, very quick on your decision. You have to be very firm, but you also have to be totally fair. And if you think it's a foul, you have to give it. And then you stand by your decision. And that's what refereeing is all about. So that leads on to VAR and who would be able to judge VAR. Well, I think that you could have a panel of players and referees, and they could make a fairly quick decision. But I do believe that in this day and age, particularly the Premier League, offsides should be automated. There really should be. You shouldn't have to dwell ages on offside. It should be absolutely like tennis. It should be in or out. You know, there's a camera eye. The technology, I'm sure, is there to do it. If you in every stadium, why not do that? Which begs the question, why do we need assistant referees? Because at the moment, they are in a right mess because they're wandering around, giving throw-ins and occasionally pointing to the corner flag. They very rarely get fouls. Sometimes they do, but most of the time they're told not to bother. And they occasionally give an offside, but only in the last resort, if it's so obvious that they don't feel that they're going to be undermined by VAR. So I think there's a real issue there about technology working. The other issue, though, is penalty kicks, late challenges, who last touched the ball, that sort of thing, before it went out. Well, that's not that difficult to do. A referee should be fit and up with play and be able to see things. If they can't see things and they get things wrong, dump them because they're not good enough and get somebody else in that is. I know clubs suffer from this, but my God, clubs have suffered from VAR all over the place with, you know, decisions being overturned, VAR decisions that were fairly obvious, like the offside not being given. In my mind, referees, particularly when they've got to the stage, the top of the Premier League, should be able to give very, very clear and accurate decisions, probably in the 90% pluses, really. They're trained, they're professional, they're intelligent, generally, they're astute, but they've got there by a real grind. They've had to work really hard to get there. You know, you've got to be fit, you've got to be dedicated. You don't just go there because you're a mate of somebody and you've come from the northeast of England. You go there because, you know, you've done fantastically well at grassroots and county level and national league level, football league level, championship level, and then Premier League. So they ought to be able to give, you know, a handball. They ought to be able to judge when it's accidental and when it's intentional. And they ought to be able to, you know, decide quickly, generally to the, you know, so that fans understand. If you take, you know, the current handball rule, I've no idea what to say to a referee if they're watching, you know, Premier League football. I know what to say to a referee when they're doing grassroots football, which is don't give handball unless you really think the player's trying to get away with it. In other words, don't give a handball just because somebody shot the ball straight at their arm. Just play on. It's fine. You can justify your decision as being accidental, no intention. And I really wish we could go to that level. In other words, make it simple, you know, but the difficult stuff, the technical stuff, like offsides, whether the ball went over the line or not, maybe whether it's a corner or not. I mean, how many times do we see the ball given over the line for a goal, and yet you think, well, that's gone over for a corner, and the line's been so play on because they can't see through the goalposts and the melee of players. So let technology do that. You know, it's very simple. With a little chip in a ball, the minute it goes over the white line, it goes buzz to say it's gone over the line. And then you know it's a throw-in or a goal kick or a corner. So I think if we could just try and get to those levels, life would be so much easier for everybody. Fans, referees, players, the lot. It won't happen, of course, because football doesn't work like that.
The application of the law, the handball law, at grassroots level, you've just described something that everyone would love to see. If you think someone's trying to get away with something, or if they've inadvertently blocked it with their arm on the goal line, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, they've taken advantage. They might not want to take an advantage, but they might have actually tried to take an advantage by running out with their arms in the air.
It's
a very, very stupid thing to do.
It seems as if that could be applied far more simply, getting back to basics in terms of the essence of the law there. Obviously, there's always going to be a subjective grey area with certain things. Did someone try to get away with it? You just said, there might be some scenarios where you're not quite sure if they're trying to get away with it or not. You have to either give the benefit of the doubt one way or the other then, and that's fair enough. And I think football fans will be okay with that by and large, apart from, you know, their very biased views on the day, maybe, you know, but in the heat of the moment aside, they would probably think, okay, that was open to interpretation. But it's when Lewis Dunk's getting penalised for a penalty, and you were going to say that, Peter, weren't you? Ridiculous. He's sliding in with his arms in a natural position. It glances off his back onto his elbow behind him. He's got no idea where the ball's going, other than the fact the players decided to try and cut it back behind Dunk to avoid being blocked by his sliding block, as it would have been. He's obviously got no intention to play the ball with his arm. Though, and there's a number of other examples we could give. That's what we need to see stopped.
Yeah. Because that infuriates everyone, doesn't it? It's about interpretation. Because with the Lewis Dunk handball, it was about him being interpreted by VAR that he had made his body big, too big, by putting his arm out. The fact that he needed to do that just to land on the ground with his elbow to stop himself going flat bang on his back wasn't taken into account.
Well, that is
not a very clever way of looking at things.
There was a
handball very shortly afterwards where a player just slapped the ball away. He didn't really mean to do it, but it caught him by surprise and hit him on the arm. I think it was a Chelsea player, maybe. It wasn't good. It seemed to be accidental. And I thought that was strange because, in my mind, if you're going to give a penalty for Dunk, you give a penalty for that because they're both handball in that context.
I agree. And I think that's this is where I do, I mean, I agree with you that players, you know, they're maybe not the best people to, to be the interpreters of the rules. But, Stephen Warnock, I think, is very good with his analysis when he's there on the Monday mornings doing the ref watch thing. He gives the player's perspective in terms of body shape and physicality. And as you've just said there, Dunks need to be in that shape to land. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it could be useful. If a player could even just giving input rather than being the judge of a situation, if you can give input and say, no, that player would have done that because he would have had to have done that because it's a matter of safety with how he lands or trajectory to get the elevation for a header or whatever it might be. I think that's where there could be some useful input. I agree. I don't think they'd be the best suppliers of the law, but that's another matter. But Peter, you were itching to come back in there.
No, I mean, I was going to originally say Dunn's point, but I was also thinking it's even weirder with the when you're sort of attacking these days. Because, I mean, you know, it's a matter of whether you, you know, in certain situations, if you handball it at all, but even, you know, brushes your arm, like McAllister against Tottenham last year, that sort of thing, it's disallowed.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you can actually handball it, as long as you, well, certainly the rule, I still, to be honest, I sometimes don't know if it's like, well, it's changed or not, but certainly the rule was if you pass it to someone after it hits your hand, you actually can score and it's okay. It's just that you can't score yourself or something like that. And they seem to make the rules more difficult. I mean, I actually think handball should be the same at either end. What's the difference between, you know, denying a shot on goal with your hand when it's in a slight position or scoring with it? It's ridiculous that they've made it two different rules for different ends of the pitch to me. It just makes it more complicated. And the more, and the same with offside, the more complications you have, the more difficult it becomes for referees and for officials.
Well, handball's always difficult to interpret because lots of players accidentally handle the ball because they get themselves into the wrong position and they're not looking sometimes. The ball hits their hand and completely stops an attack. And you as a referee, you think, if I don't give that, I'll have about, you know, 10 players cursing me, and the, you know, the defensive team that's handled the ball will probably not care whether you give a handball or not, unless it's a penalty. So you often give penalties on the basis that the element of really sort of doubt that they probably didn't mean to handle the ball, but they've really screwed it up for the attacking side by handling the ball, and they're not very good players to let that happen. So there are sort of that really doesn't, or in the old days, that didn't really apply the laws of the game. And the laws of the game said there must be an intention to handle the ball. I mean, if a ball's hit at you very, very hard and you put your hands up, you know, in front of your face, as you may well remember Glenn Murray doing.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Wednesday, and got sent off for it, I think, for a second bookable offence, I think. Or maybe stopping a goal.
I think it was a straight red. I think it was stopping a goal scoring opportunity. It was a
straight red, although I'm sure there were players on the line because it was a free kick. But that aside, I felt at the time that that was a very harsh penalty because what are you going to do? But the fact is that it was probably about 7 or maybe 8 metres away when the player shot.
Self-preservation.
Murray probably should have got out of the way. Whether that meant it went straight in the goal or not is another matter. He probably couldn't have headed it because he probably didn't expect the Sheffield Wednesday player to smash the ball directly at his face from 7 metres. So he didn't get out of the way and he instinctively put his hands up, handled the ball. Well, you would probably have to give a penalty there because you would turn around and say, you know what, you should have got out of the way. And Murray would have said, how could I get out of the way of that? And you just say, well, you should have got penalty kick. But whether you would have sent a player off for that in the olden days, I doubt.
That's my problem with that decision, was the sending off.
I mean, it wasn't a problem in the end, though. It's like, well, probably one of the best nights at the Annex, that.
Exactly.
And well, there is that.
And they missed the penalty, and we were all delighted. But if they scored the penalty that we'd lost, it would have been awful. But there you go. I mean, and it would have been based on the referee interpretation of that law, which was deemed at the time to be perfectly okay. And it probably was, in hindsight, but it was a bit tough. You know, you'd have called the referee very soft if he hadn't given the penalty, or probably biased, actually, or a cheat, people would have called him wrongly. And if he hadn't sent him off, maybe Wednesday would have gone ballistic at Murray not being sent off for denying an obvious goal-scoring opportunity.
Yeah. Well, moving swiftly on, there's one damning condemnation and two massive rants I need to get off my chest, and you'll feel free to join in with these as well. Before we get on to that, one player who I'm wondering whether you would have liked to have reffed him at any point. He was squeaky clean gentleman of the field, of course, all the way through his career, Roy Keane. He was headbutted, apparently, while representing in his media capacity, alongside Micah Richards, who's a big fan of Roy Keane. Sounds like a bad time to headbutt a player who's got a reputation for being a bit spiky anyway. I'm not quite sure what happened there. I think he irritated somebody of the opposition supporting affiliation or whatever it was. I'm not sure of the details. Crazy stuff. Would you like to have dealt with the likes of Mr. Keane during your time, Graham?
No, it would have been really, really. I did deal with a few players at a fairly high level who weren't really difficult. I once had a player that used to just stand in front of me every time there was stoppage in play, right next to me, right in front of me, just to annoy me. And I found
really,
it really intimidating.
Shit housing the ref. That's
harassing the ref. Yeah, absolutely.
I've heard of getting in the ref's ear, but not shit housing. Yeah. That's
so
quite.
I would step away, you know, to get out of the way so I could see the ball and see through the player, if you like, see around the player. You'd just step in front of me again. And there's nothing really in the laws of the game to say a player can't do that. So I asked him to move, and he said no.
And then,
of course, you start thinking, I'm going to caution you for ungentlemanly conduct. And that's when you get into the, if you're a strong referee, I'm not saying I was particularly, but if you're a strong referee, you start to get really heavy on players and you actually show cards, even if it's just, you know, just to shut them up. But the best piece of advice I ever got was, single out the Roy Keane, go to Roy Keane and talk to him. Say, you're having a really good game. Or did you see the AC Milan game the other night? Things like that. The other method is I gave a throw in there just now, but I'm not sure I got that right. I think it might have been your throw, not the opposition's. But yeah, you know, I thought you'd like to know that. And they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do and what to say. And they don't become your friend, but they suddenly think, I can't be bothered with that. But if you go through a game being poker-faced and giving decisions and saying shut up all the time and going, that's it, I don't care, that's it, I've given it, and not explaining things, they'll get you. They'll say, what do you think you're doing? You know, and they'll start questioning your abilities and skills in a way that doesn't get them sent off.
Adopting mind games of Mind Games United. Sorry, Manchester United. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, oh, I quite like that. That's good. Yeah,
it's an interesting technique, which I was told about very late, never really put into action. But it dawned on me what a clever move that would be.
Yeah, that's very good.
Players, find the difficult one, the one that's always ranting and questioning, and get into their head.
Because they're going to otherwise influence their team.
You know, easygoing and polite and friendly way, not in an aggressive or confrontational way. And then they get bewildered by it and don't think, they think, why is he always talking to me? You know, leave me alone. And they go away and they don't go near you then, you know,
because
they don't want another conversation about whether it was a corner or a goal kick, or that's a good kit they've got on, isn't it? I love that with that kit. It's still good.
Oh, I love that. There's one final thing on refereeing before we get onto my rant as well. I don't know if you saw this week, there was a Swedish referee who's tried to identify and interpret a loophole in the law to do with free kicks. I think he was saying if something to do with the contact, when the first contact, a player is onside, and then if they move into an offside position and no additional contact has been made, they're onside. So the notion was he plonks the ball on his foot, balances it on his foot, player then goes into onside position and he scoops the ball, having not lost contact with the ball, and it could be onside. And then I think there was a reply from IFAB saying, well, the laws are a broad church, and then in terms of like the overall rule, and then there's a matter of spirit of the game and interpretation.
Yes, that's right.
And he said there's a way we could loophole our way out of that.
Yeah.
But I thought it was quite entertaining that they came up with that. I think it was Swedish. It might have been Norwegian, actually.
Yeah.
Not quite sure. But,
I mean, the spirit of the game was often about interpretation and a referee being strong enough to use the spirit of the game to stop things going on. I mean, as a player, I used to think it was really clever as a striker for a while, shouting keeper's ball so that the defence might pass the ball back to the keeper, or pass it back to the keeper, and then I'd stand next to the keeper and score. And of course, I wouldn't be offside because it had been played to me by a defender. But a referee got wise to that and booked me and said...
Yeah, this gamesmanship, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I said, well, it's not in the laws of the game, so it's in the spirit of it.
The same with suddenly shouting next to someone, screaming to the point of disorientating them. Again, it's against the laws, the spirit of the game. So the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I did ask that to somebody once.
I'll scream at someone on the pitch, you know, because screaming goes on all the time, particularly when someone gets fouled.
That's true. Right. Okay. Damning condemnation and two rants. Damning condemnation. We're not going to dwell on this matter, but Burnley came back into the Premier League this season and they've changed their style. Vincent Kompany, lovely guy, seems to come across very well. Obviously a very good coach. He started in Belgium, got the job with Burnley, got them up as playing a much better brand of football, winning the title, getting into the Premier League. Congratulations to him. They've started, and I don't want to make too much of this, but they've started to include black players in their team, which is interesting. It's a bit of a change from their usual modus operandi, one or two exceptions aside. So everything about Burnley is different. Better brand of football, more inclusive style of team. Vincent Kompany, of course, as well, being a black manager as the coach. Everything's great, except same old when it comes to the fans. There was some very scummy behaviour at one of the games, I think, very early in the season. Well, we were already over early in the season, but I think there was...
They've only played three games.
Yeah,
but I think it was is it the first game of the season?
Yeah, the City game, somebody invaded the pitch, didn't they, or something? Or...
Yeah, and there was a lot of scummy behaviour going on. There was some trouble, I think, as well. And then the Tottenham game, apparently a lump of concrete was thrown at the team coach, hitting it. Thankfully, nobody was injured or harmed. Again, some things never change, do they? And I know this isn't every Burnley fan, but they do have a horribly scummy reputation. It's very disappointing and so tediously predictable to hear another issue coming up. So twice in three home games, the fans haven't behaved themselves.
Russ, I think you have to be careful about the lump of concrete because they were probably kids. They were probably, they probably weren't at the game. They probably knew the score and knew which way a team coach would come.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make, you don't have to be very clever to work out that if the team coach is going back to Manchester Airport, it's got to go on the M62 or something. The timing would probably mean that they haven't had enough time to leave the ground, get to wherever it was, find a piece of concrete and throw it over the bridge. They may well have done, but...
Well, there might be fans that weren't attending, I suppose.
Based on the last time I went to Burnley, they could have taken the concrete with them to the ground. They didn't get any bag searched last time I went there.
There could well be. I mean, I do... I mean, I think I told you, I remember when we won at Newcastle in 1979 to get promotion. You know, the same thing happened to the supporters coach.
Yeah, we're talking about this just on Tuesday, weren't we?
From the bridge on the A1. So I think, and I don't think it caused any damage, but it was really dangerous. I don't think that for the life of me that they were Newcastle fans that were at the game. I think they knew there would be football supporter coaches driving down this particular dual coach. It's as simple as that. And, you know, it's probably the same kids that would go on those funny wheelies on their bicycles, you know, up in the air in the middle of the high street in front of
everyone does that now, don't they? What the hell's that all about?
and that's the sort of, I just think that that's an odd thing to do. But maybe if you're 12 and a bit leery and not particularly pleasant, you might want to throw a piece of concrete on a moonlight.
Not what I did when I was a kid, I have to say. But I take your point. There might not have been fans, or at least not regular fans, and they probably weren't at the game. But it's still, you know, locals in an area doing something like that, whatever the age.
Well, which, it's unusual, isn't it?
It kills someone. Age,
but it probably has something to do with, you know, local kids, I think.
Yeah, fair enough.
But saying that, Burnley fans are not pleasant. And they have horrible chants, and they probably had to rein those in. And it's just a matter of time, I think, before Kompany gets sacked and they bring in some float the ball, pump the ball from the back.
They can swap with Everton.
Yes,
I knew you were going to say that.
They could, and they both would benefit from that, wouldn't they?
Probably. Company would be nearer to Manchester, and Sean Dyche will be back in his spiritual home.
He'd start telling the players, yeah, bump the ball forward, and this is what you do. And I don't want to hear it, what you would like to do. You're doing what I do. And, you know.
Right.
Yeah, grow 6 inches or you're not starting up front.
Rants. I'm expecting support from you guys in this one, but I don't know, maybe not. Who knows? Two rants before we round off. Spanish football scenario and Jordan Henderson. Spanish football, first of all, what an absolute shambles. I think we can all agree, whatever you think of this, a total shambles of a situation. Of course, we've got Hermoso, who was the one of the key players at the Spanish World Cup for the women's team. They won the tournament. All the players were embraced by Rubiales. There was some inappropriate, according to the players, behaviour. Kissing on the lips while grabbing the back of the head does seem a bit weird to me. I know there's cultural anomalies from one country to another, but obviously the people from that culture, from Spain, the women involved, didn't think it was a matter of appropriateness at all. They've had an issue with it. They've had an issue with Spanish. It seems... Initially, it was going to be to do with the coach. What's his name? Vilder, is it?
Yeah.
I think it seemed, my understanding of it was more they had an issue with him prior in the build-up to the World Cup when 15 people stepped away, and then they were eventually persuaded, some of them, to come back. 8 of them were persuaded to come back. 3 of them were then picked. And they went on, despite those adversities, to win the World Cup with a coach they didn't like.
Yeah.
It seems there might be more to the original issues than has originally met the eye. But also, we've now got this situation that's happened in the celebrations on the pitch, you know, the inappropriate behaviour. Clearly, it was deemed as inappropriate by the people for whom it was acted upon. And Rubiales has dug his heels in. He's done a Wolf of Wall Street-style defiant speech, which was very weird. Very unsavoury, with a captive audience applauding him, most of the audience, including the coach. The coach was already on sticky ground. FIFA then have subsequently suspended Rubiales for 90 days. Mm. And the Spanish Federation have subsequently appointed a replacement called, I think, Nacho is his name, who apparently is also of the same set, whatever that means. So not necessarily an improvement. However, that guy has sacked Vilda from the coaching role, which is interesting. He's now up in arms, complaining it's unfair and that things have been judged on football. He can understand if he's done something wrong, he'd get sacked. But judged on behaviour, he doesn't think it should be. There is an inherent issue in Spanish football, a macho culture within the Spanish Federation and within the coaching setup here, clearly, because there is a major, major rift between the female playing staff and those male figures of authority within the Spanish game. We've had the farcical scenario of the mother, Rubiales' mother, going on hunger strike in church over the witch hunt, the inhumane witch hunt of her son, you know, a typical mummy's boy scenario here we're talking here. And I found the whole thing so unsavoury. What an absolute own goal of all own goals this is for anybody connected with the Spanish Federation and the coaching staff, because they've just made things worse and worse and worse for themselves by digging their heels in, denying they've done anything wrong. Rubiales giving a really, really weak apology with that classic hook. I'm sorry if I've offended anybody. I didn't expect I had, but sorry if I have, was the general vibe. How many times have we heard that? I'm sorry if I've offended somebody. Yeah. Suggests that they don't think that someone should have been offended.
Yeah. You say it all the time, Russ, don't you, on the pod?
I do. That's another matter, Peter.
I agree with you. I think my two things that are so... I mean, one, I genuinely... How inept an organisation are you that FIFA has to step in and act for you in a scandal? FIFA, who literally are rife with scandals all the time and do absolutely nothing about it, they've been the ones who take action here. I mean, that is hilarious. And the second thing is, just the real tragedy of all this is, no one really talks about the fact that Spain won the World Cup deservedly. I mean, obviously I wanted England to win that game, but Spain were brilliant. And the way they behaved and the way they... after, you know, all the scandals going on, and then losing 4-0 to Japan in the group stage when they could have, you know, fallen apart. The way they recovered from that to come through and win the tournament has been completely lost because of this one dickhead being backed up by a lot of other dickheads. And it's, like, it's completely overshadowed the football, and it's a real shame.
Yeah, not only that, but the success story itself already was an interesting story because when the run-up to the game, I didn't know anything about this issue, actually. I'd not heard anything about it. And they were talking about it in the run-up to the game, maybe the day, couple of days before, and then in the build-up on the match day. And my wife was watching it with me, and she said, ooh, they've got a reason to win this because they've obviously got issues with the hierarchy and with the coaching staff. They've got a reason to win this. And she was convinced they would win, and I agreed with her at the time. I thought, shit, I think you're right. So there is that rising above adversity element to the story, as well as the general success of winning a World Cup. So there's a magnificent story there at that stage, but it's undermined.
And it's all been destroyed by actions of one person and then the ineptness of the organisation afterwards. It's just really sad.
Incredible. Nacho, the guy that's come in to replace Rubiales for the 90 days, he's mates with Seferin of UEFA, who are an inept and pathetic organisation anyway. They're mates. He's a vice president at UEFA.
I think the key to all this is, if you think about, okay, so the Football Association gets a lot of bad press, and has had many, many times, but when it came to national coaches, when it came to Hoddle and Allardyce, it did move pretty quickly. And I think, you know, the Football Association isn't just one person. It's a governing body. And that governing body, would not tolerate. It wouldn't say to the chair of the Football Association, well, it's down to you now. Whatever you want to do, just don't do something. So I'm amazed that the Spanish FA haven't sat round a table and said, this is intolerable, we are sacking him, you know, you can be in charge, if you like, assistant, but you must apply for the job.
I think the implication, Graham...
You know, and if he takes us to court, so be it, we'll go to court because he won't have a leg to stand on.
I think the implication, Graham, is that they don't have jurisdiction to sack him. The only way they could get him out, if he doesn't resign, is for the Minister of Sport to intervene, which probably is about to happen, I would imagine.
That would have happened in England, wouldn't it?
It would have happened in England, yeah, definitely.
If Allardyce had said, I'm not going, you know, it would have been like European Super League. If there's something big enough where the public start getting upset...
The paradox is,
with a football matter, then the government starts to get involved.
The paradox is that represents government intervention, which of course FIFA has against its statutes, which is ironic, isn't it, as well? But actually it would be the right thing to do in that circumstance. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy situation. It's madness, isn't it? And they're damaging. I think, unfortunately, I think Spain, I wouldn't say, I've had a lot of interaction with Spanish people. I've met many people. I've been there. I quite like a lot of elements of the culture. And of course, their history is very interesting, that Franco was still in charge until the mid 70s. Yeah. So they are a relatively young nation in terms of their current incarnation. But when something like this happens, it makes me think of things that I hadn't thought of about how backward it can be in some regards. It's really bad, and it's painted on a global scale for everyone to see. It's the very worst case of doing your dirty washing in public, isn't it? This, it's absolutely awful. And there's so many great people in Spain, and I count absolutely nobody in the Spanish Federation as any of them, but it's just baffling that they would undermine themselves in this great moment of jubilation. And they've created a global farce. Maybe, I know Alan said, of this parish, said that he thinks it's gone out of all proportion with the news coverage and things. But and I can sort of see his point. But in the end, you know, if someone digs their heels in and this story just gains traction.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, that's the story, isn't it? The story is the intransigence and the difficultness of the Spanish FA and the incompetence generally now. It's not, you know, if they just acted quickly the next day and said, you can't do that, you've been sacked. That would have ended the story probably at that point. I mean, it's been almost a month since the game.
Yeah. And it's still the main headline for a lot of sporting
organizations. It's insane. It's like, Yeah, they just act quickly and it doesn't become a story.
Yeah,
exactly. And now the latest thing is that she's now filed for to press legal charges against him. She wouldn't have done that if he'd have apologised, albeit emptily, and then resigned. I think, and if there'd been some suggestion of changes within the organisation, that probably would have been the end of it. But because he's digging his heels in, she's very quite rightly gone, okay, you're digging your heels in, I'm going to dig my heels in. This is a sexual assault, so we're now going to make this a legal matter because you haven't shown any contrition and you haven't acted in accordance with...
Didn't he threaten to sue her at one point as well? I mean,
threatening legal action against her for insinuating something that didn't happen. And they've tried to change the narrative. It's very, very unpleasant. The way the whole Me Too movement, this is almost a classic example of that, isn't it? With this trying to change the narrative. No, you didn't do this. You were consenting. Telling somebody what they were doing. They've clearly
said it's the whole fake news, like Donald Trump sort of thing, isn't
it? Truth.
If you just say it's like, it's fake news constantly. People just believe you after a while because they're like, they don't know what to believe.
No, Trump's turned America into a tin pot dictatorship for 5 minutes, didn't he, when all that stuff was going on?
Perhaps an intrepid reporter at the Evening Argus could interview Ansu Fati about his opinion of whistle.
Oh, that's a good call. Spanish international, of course.
I would imagine it'd be no comment, really.
Yeah. There's been criticism, hasn't there? I mean, 81 members of the female, the eligible to be Spanish international set, have all said they will refuse to play while he's in charge. He's still digging his heels in. He's still not resigned. Yeah. Incredible situation. When you've got over 80 professional footballers of the highest quality in Spain, and they've got a very wide range of good qualities there, are all saying they're not going to play while he's in charge. You're thinking maybe I've overstepped the mark here.
It must be a bit weird if you're, Rebellas, and you're going into work because you haven't resigned. You're going into your office, at which probably, his assistant is now, and you're saying, I'll go in this office here. Well, what are you going to do? Well, I'm still the, the head of the FA. You're not. Well, I am the head of it. No, I'm the interim head of it. No, you're not. I'm the head of it. It must be.
Sounds like a Python sketch, doesn't it?
Yes. It would be very funny, wouldn't it?
It would be, yeah. And unless the Minister of Sport intervenes, 90 days are going to go by and he's going to come back to office. And they've got games coming up imminently. Who are they going to be playing? They're going to be playing their 81st to 92nd choice starting 11, aren't they?
Well, I'm not even sure they'll do that because no one's going to agree to do it. They're literally, even if people don't necessarily agree, they're going to look at it and go, I'm going to get so much backlash that I just don't want to do it.
Yeah, it's going to look bad, isn't it? If you're the 82nd best Spanish player, you look like a real dick if you're going.
Yeah, you're like, I did amazingly when I was young. I got a cap for Spain, and then grandkids look it up and they go, "Oh, that's because no one else would play because of sexual assault, and you still played." There's not much to boast about, really.
I didn't think it was sexual assault, really. So I was prepared to play, So
that's maybe the wrong word, but
it was just one match, and I did get £15 for it. So
exactly. Yeah, so it's not really sexual. I mean, it's so mad.
I'm sorry if you're offended by me playing.
Yes.
Anyway, we won't dwell on that anymore because I'm sure the story is still unfolding and there'll be more.
Oh, yeah, he'll go, won't he? He'll
He's got to go.
It's hard to see what else they could possibly do in the end.
Yeah, I mean,
playoff, I suppose. That's what it's about, isn't it?
It's like a guy standing on a burning ship with no one else around him going, yeah, I'm still the captain. You know, eventually that ship's going into the water.
Yeah.
And at least he won't burn anymore. He'll cool off a bit as he sinks to the bottom of the ocean. Anyway, moving swiftly on, the final rant.
Lovely analogy there, Russ.
Thank you. That's better than my usual, actually. In other words, it was less than awful. So the final rant, and it's another one, and feel free to join in on this one, Jordan Henderson. Jordan Henderson, we have flagged this up before, and I've had a rant about it before. He was championing the cause of LGBTQ rights. He was having a lot of communications with Liverpool. Liverpool supporters during his time there. He was there for a number of years. His reason to want to move on from Liverpool is fair enough. No one person really made it sound like they wanted to keep him into the longer term. He was still under contract, but you could see it wasn't going anywhere forwards. And his statement subsequently has suggested that he didn't have any better options in terms of there wasn't a decent offer from the Premier League or any of the other major leagues. Don't know if that's true or not, but his option was...
It would have been Sunderland, wouldn't it?
Sunderland, yeah, of his heart and all that. Yeah. Well, that's definitely not Premier League, that's for sure. Anyway, so he's opted to go to Saudi Arabia. He signed a deal. He's not reacted in any way to the very snidey, unpleasant and signing announcement where they grayed out the rainbow flag, which is a real two fingers up to him and everybody else who he's been supporting in the past. He didn't react to that at all. He didn't react to any criticism from the LGBTQ community or anybody else in the media for a few weeks. And then he was called up to the England squad. So he preempted the fact that he was going to get asked about it. So he took the initiative and approached the media and spoke to some people and did some interviews. Fair enough in that respect. But his arguments are pathetic, absolutely pathetic. I'm going to read the statement here. He said, "I can understand the frustration. I can understand the anger. I get it." Does he really? "All I can say around that is that I'm sorry that they feel like that." Again, this is this language, this semantics thing, isn't it? "I'm sorry they feel like that, as if they shouldn't feel like that, but I'm sorry they do. I'm sorry that this doesn't quite marry." He says, "My intention was never, ever to hurt anyone. My intention has always been to help causes and communities where I felt that they've asked for my help. People will see this club come with loads of money and he's just gone. Yeah, I'm going. When in reality, that wasn't the case at all. People can believe me or not, but in my life and my career, money has never been a motivation, ever." That's a separate sentence, the word ever, by the way. "Don't get me wrong. When you move, the business deal has to be tight. You have to have financials. You have to feel wanted. You have to feel valued. And money is a part of that, but that wasn't the sole reason." He also went on to say, "I can't promise anything, but what I can do is sit here and say I have my values and beliefs, and I strongly believe that me playing in Saudi Arabia is a positive thing." And there's one final bit, which he says, "When I was making the decision, the way that I tried to look at it was, I felt as though by myself not going, we could all bury our heads in the sand, pardon the pun, and criticise different cultures and different countries from afar, but then nothing's going to happen, nothing's going to change," which implies that he thinks he's somehow doing good by going over there, having had his previous opinions, which he didn't question the mocking of when he signed and they did the publicity signing. Peter, you want to get in on this, don't you?
Yeah.
I thought you might.
I thought the interview was pretty, yeah. I thought the interview actually itself was quite weak as well. So to me, the first question would have been, and the only question would have been, "Do you not feel like a massive hypocrite?" And he didn't actually use the word hypocrite and it's like that. He's a massive, massive hypocrite to me. It's like, you can't campaign for LGBTQ plus rights and then go to a country where you can be executed for being gay. That's just absolutely ludicrous. And it's like, I mean, I don't think any of the players should go there. I think the whole thing's pretty distasteful anyway. Saudi Arabian League and what's happened with it. And yeah, the idea that they want to get into your Champions League and want to get into that sort of thing is disgraceful. But putting that aside, when you've had you've supposedly campaigned on that side like Jordan Henderson has, to then go and do that, it's basically just a two fingers up at all the people you've been campaigning with and fighting for this thing for.
Yeah,
and
no
to have even the thought that he might change the views that thousands of years held or like whatever, by their religious faiths and that sort of thing, it's just hilarious. I mean, the idea that he might change any thought in anyone's mind over there is just crazy. No, all that's going to happen is they're not going to allow him to say anything. And if he does say anything, he'll get arrested probably briefly or quietly taken aside and told, "Do not say anything like that again."
Exactly. By saying nothing, he's bent over and taken it, hasn't he, with that rainbow greyed outfit alone. That alone.
And this is why I love beating Newcastle so much last weekend.
Yeah,
it's just like, Saudi Arabia. It's just like everything that's wrong with football is state ownership to me. City, Newcastle, Paris Saint-Germain, all of it. It's just disgusting. And it should be absolutely banned in my view.
Graham, if I can bring you in on this, Graham, because we went to Seagulls Over London this week and we had an interesting interview guests, Kevin Miles, who's the chief executive of the FSA. Many people would have seen him talking about things around England tournaments. He's a regular, he's a top capper in the England setup. And Thomas Concannon, I think his name was, wasn't it? Who's his a mate of his, also a Geordie, also a Newcastle fan, and I think in a position of some significance in the FSA as well. And they were good guys, really interesting debate, had a good chat. They were asked about their affiliation with Newcastle and what they thought about the Saudis. And they said that they don't agree with it. You know, they find it unpleasant, but they did pose the question, where do you draw the line? And I think that's a fair enough question to make. But when you've got something like this, it's difficult because it, obviously with Newcastle, they're a bunch of fans supporting a club, and someone's swanned in, taken over the club. What do you then do? What do you then think? How do you react when someone's imposed themselves on your club? It's difficult. It's not easy, I have to say. Even Shebo, who's ranting on the matchday special at the weekend, said, you know, it is difficult for the Newcastle fans because they're desperate for glory. They are a big club. They should be doing better than they have done. But then you've got, when you go to Saudi Arabia, such as Jordan Henderson and very many other people besides. But the issue with Jordan is, of course, the fact that he championed LGBT rights very specifically, which the others, such as party man Neymar and everyone else, didn't.
No.
When you go to Saudi Arabia, that's a particular statement, isn't it? If you're a Newcastle fan supporting your team, I think you can still go and support the team and you can feel uncomfortable about Saudi. But if you go to Saudi Arabia to play your football, that's a whole different ball game.
But also, if you go dressed up as a sheikh, if you go dressed up as a sheikh, though, for the games, then
yeah, those guys are
idiots. Well.
They're dickheads. Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was interesting what Kevin Miles and his colleagues had to say last week about that, and I had a certain amount of sympathy for them, really. But you know, there, but for the grace of God, goes any football club that wants to be big. And you know, bar with the exception of Brighton, although many people wrongly, I think, sort of said, well, Tony Bloom gets his money from gambling, you know, and which is not entirely true. The problem I think with footballers is, and this is the difficulty, is they really, for Henderson, he was a pretty left-wing club with ideally with sort of politically correct inverted commas ideals as a football club. I've always felt a bit hard done by in the shadow of you know, real problems that they faced over the years. And in a way, footballers, I think, probably need to think about whether they're going to be a spokesperson and whether they can just dissolve quietly into the background and let the clubs do the talking rather than the players. And that applies to their agents as well. I know we want to hear from stars about certain things, but I think they should probably do everything quietly. If they, you know, if they want to give money to charities, they should do it and not tell people they're giving money to charities. They should just do it and feel good about it.
Unless you're going to have the courage of your convictions, regardless of any.
That's right. Yeah. But, you know, if you're going to go to Saudi Arabia, you probably have to come out and say, do you know what? I've got some issues with Saudi Arabia, but I need to make my family secure.
Yeah, it would have been more respected if you'd just said that.
It is fantastic at this stage of my career, and it's as simple as that. And you might hate me for it, and I'm sorry if you feel that, but I need to look at, you know, at financial security at my age. And people would just go, you're probably a multi-millionaire already, so you could retire now and still be comfortable till you're dead. But why players don't do that, you know, Southgate got himself into a mess the other day as well, I thought. You know,
yes.
He didn't want to talk about politics, and yet he finds himself having to talk about politics. politics.
He was, I thought he was naive not to appreciate that would come up. He seemed quite surprised by it. And I mean, it was a really obvious question to ask.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it wasn't, why he didn't know it was going to come up.
Are we at the stage where he could have actually started to exclude Jordan Henderson from the team? Based on his age, you can actually, you could quite conveniently say to Jordan behind the scenes, look, this is going to be a firestorm. We don't like what you've done. And unfortunately, we think you're unlikely to get back in the team. Now, I know that's cutting off an avenue, but you could do that if you wanted to.
It probably isn't a firestorm, is it? That's the thing. It's probably something which will come and go. I mean, you know, you'll go to Wembley, watch England, and Henderson might play, and he will not get booed because 75-80% of the fans there will go storm the teacup, you know. They were just like they wouldn't boo Newcastle players playing for England. And they wouldn't expect Newcastle players to have to justify being picked for England because they play for a club. You know, Eddie Howe's the same, isn't it? I don't want to talk about politics. I'm here to run a football club. Henderson should have done the same. I don't want to talk about politics. I'm here to play professional football. I got an offer I couldn't refuse. Thank you.
And if it's in England, it is a different scenario, isn't it? Because you can have multi-ownership. Sainsbury's have got part ownership. Saudi, apparently, you know. Yeah. So what do? Do you stop shopping in Sainsbury's? Yeah. There are, I can see the point about, you know, where do you draw the line? But when it's something as ostensibly ridiculous and offensive as that, you know, when they're mocking the rainbow flag thing, you think that's gone too far.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were going to do that. But,
I think I'd have probably respected Henderson more if he just said, I got an offer beyond my wildest dreams to play in this league, where my family for the next 100 years will be able to live off. Yeah. You know, if he'd said that, people would have, I mean, I'd have still not really respected him, but at least they'd have been like, well, at least he's honest.
Yeah, so
it's not all about money. What other reasons did you possibly go to the Saudi Arabian League, which is such a pointless league compared to the league you could have played in?
They've still spent less money than the Premier League. They still have very, very small numbers of star players in comparison to this stage. The only reason is money. And if, as you said, if you said, look, I do hold by my beliefs, but when all said and done, I've compromised it for money and I'm going to enjoy trying to, the new challenge.
Someone made the point that he wasn't really available this summer. No one really talked about him being available. I read that people were saying somewhere, and it might have been on Twitter, I've read things like that, or on one of the WhatsApp groups. But we got Milner, who was like 5-6 years older than him. Yes, he was a free transfer, but he's playing quite a key part for us. Got top six last year, got to Europe. Henderson could have got an equivalent move, got paid a significant amount of money still, you know. And so it basically, you know, and played in a proper league rather than the embarrassment that is the Saudi league, where you just think you can throw money at it.
What would you call it? It's obviously not a farmer's league. What's it called? A camel's league? I don't know. There's got to be some equivalent expression, isn't there, for this? I don't know. What would that be? Dare we even ask?
I think possibly, interestingly, I wonder if Henderson was inferring, probably wasn't, but I might think he was, that by him and other star players going to the Saudi Arabian league, that more would follow, and more would follow in order to make it comparable with other European leagues. Potentially.
I think mainly at the moment it's players who are mainly over the hill, with a few exceptions. There was a really young player, is it Vega or something like that, from Spain who's supposed to be really good. And I think he's the only one really who's coming, who's a real like young talent. Everyone else has been basically past it, I'd say now.
Yeah, but Peter, if you were starting to build so that you would attract, let's say, a player like Enciso not going to the Premier League, but going straight to Saudi Arabia to play in competitive football because the money was fantastic and the standard had improved immensely, and that they were playing, you know, against not European teams, but top Asian teams, maybe, and then they would have a chance at the World Club Championship and et cetera, and still be playing international. But the thing was that, you know, that you've got this fantastic league suddenly coming from nowhere, the equivalent of maybe La Liga one day, okay? And then all these players are saying, yes, of course we're going to play with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, we wouldn't be playing with Saudi Arabia if they hadn't dropped their authoritarian laws about LGBTQ. And in a way, that's just pathetic, isn't it? And naive, because it's not going to happen. But I wonder if that's the goal, and that players and maybe agents are being told, do you know where it's baby steps, but we're going to, the regime will change only when we become westernized, like, you know, we have Premier League football and we have wonderful facilities, you know, we're a tourist resort, a bit like the Emirates, but, you know, and everybody wants to come and, yes, hello, yes, and we like gays too. I wonder if that's what the it's all about at the end of the day, he said.
Yeah, it's incredible. What I will say is that Jordan Henderson has come out of this looking very bad indeed. It's awful, really, at this stage.
The it's week- up there with the interview that Prince Andrew did, isn't it, really, in terms of actually clearing his name from accusations.
There's no sweating really, and there's no Peters, but it's more or less the same. Yeah,
obviously different things that he's done. But, I mean, in terms of success of changing public ideas of his actions, I would say it's as successful, although fewer people obviously will see it from in being aesthetic. But it was, yeah, it was just a really poorly thought through interview. And he comes to look poorly.
Jordan Henderson has been employed by Liverpool, what, 7-8 years, something like that, maybe more.
More, I think.
He's going to be on major wages. Major, major wages. He does not, unless he's appallingly bad at managing his finances, he doesn't need financially to go to Saudi Arabia. He would have been able to get another job at another club somewhere in the equation.
He could have gone done a Milner and gone to Luton, the up and coming little club in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Help them.
Or he could have gone back to Sunderland, as Peter said, or he could have done, there's a number of things he could have done. If only had a moral stance, which he's purported to have had before, and that was the only option with any monetary significance versus the norm, I would have turned that down. Definitely. I know I would, as my moral compass would not allow me to go to Saudi Arabia, not when I'm that wealthy already, or should be that wealthy already. And I would have just taken, a job, the next best job in the UK or somewhere interesting abroad. I might have championed a cause if I could afford it. I might even say, Joe, well, go back to the club of my heart or this, that or the other and take a hit on wages. Don't mind that. Just to play football and be a local hero for a couple
of
weeks.
They are looking for camel instructors, though, I believe.
Well,
they're prepared to pay a lot of money.
Now you've said that. Actually, Saudi Arabia's okay, isn't it? It's not too bad. The weather's all right. Yeah. You know, there's air conditioning.
You need to go into your contract that every time you tweet about Saudi Arabia positively, you get more money, like in like Neymar did, apparently.
A camel instructor reference. I'm a driving instructor, for anyone that doesn't know. Yes. Maybe, I might look into that, actually, Graham. Cheers. Yeah. Excellent. On that note...
I'm actually an agent. I didn't let that, you know... Jordan Henderson deals through me, right?
No, you're going to love it. Anyway, no, the farce that is football, this crazy sceptre denial stuff continues, doesn't it? It'll go on forever and we'll have plenty more to discuss. We've chatted quite a bit tonight, I have to say, a bit of an epic. But it's an international break. We've got less stuff to talk about football-wise. So I'm sure this will be a nice filler between now and when we play our next game, which is, 8 days from today as we sit here talking, the Man United game away on the weekend or after this one now, where we've done the double. We're hoping to make it 3 in a row. I'm not going...
4 in a row.
4 in a row, actually.
In the league, with the 4-0 last 2 years ago.
The FA Cup, forget about that crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 in a row in the league. Yeah, Peter, you're not going, are you? Same as me. Graham, are you going to that one, the Man United game?
No, certainly going to go to over the next
been there, done that. Yeah. Got the T-shirt, yeah. I got the Euro T-shirt.
I see it sold out.
There we are. There we go. But we are going to City. We're going to City. Are you going to that one, Graham?
I'm thinking about it.
Okay, we might see you there. Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. So everyone, thanks for listening. It's been a pleasure. Graham, thank you for coming back on. It's been really good to hear your insight into the refereeing and refereeing assessing worlds, and also your opinions on various other subjects. So thank you. We'll have you back on, I'm sure. And Peter, stand or fall?
Up the Albion.
Yeah. Sports Social Podcast Network.